Hello and welcome to Hockey Development Talk. Today I am joined by the guru of coaching, Danny Newcombe. Hello, Danny.
Morning.
How are you?
Hey, I'm all right, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Good, good. So I thought we would just start with a little bit around yourself and your roles within this coaching world that you're in, if you'd like to share away.
Thanks. Current roles, so assistant coach for the Welsh senior men, and I've been doing that for about 7 years now, working with Zach. I'm leading the sort of under 23 and under 21 men in Wales now as well, which is exciting and good for me. I'm assistant coach at Reading Hockey Club with Jason. For this year, which has been great fun. And then I'm a sort of lecturer in sport coaching MP at Oxford Brookes University, and then do all other coach development bits and pieces around.
Yes, yeah, you do indeed. Yeah. So within that current roles there, I suppose there's quite a lot of similarity with regards to Wales and Reading, quite an elite group of players. But do you still feed lower down with some of the development within both roles?
Not too much anymore. When I was at Southgate, I used to run an academy, which I really used to enjoy, and I used to run one in Oxford Hockey Club, which was great. And then I have been doing a bit with the Oxford Brookes ladies hockey team this year, which has been very good fun, and recalibrating me coaching. In girls and coaching at sort of more of a development level has been good fun. So yeah, I don't do too much or enough lower stuff anymore.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and with the university itself within the coaching world there, I mean, that's not specific to hockey. That is generally sports coaching as a whole. So is that all year groups within that degree? Is that how does that work for you? And
yeah, so I sort of run the coaching strand that runs through the degree, so first year, second year, third years. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we have a mixture of students who want to be primary school teachers, secondary school teachers, coaches, sport development. So yeah, we generally look at coaching and sport and PE as the wider rather than just hockey. We've got exciting projects going on in primary schools where we developed a primary school curriculum. So, and then it's quite nice to have lots of students in the room that come from different sports and different backgrounds rather than it always being hockey.
Yeah, like a little mini community of practice, that, isn't it? I suppose in some respects. So
yeah, they're great.
They're sharing some of that. And from a coach development side of things, what are you still involved in when you get time to have an hour here, 3 hours there?
At the minute, doing a lot of sort of skill development CPD, practice design CPD, sort of coach development across a huge range of sports, from football to tennis to cricket to rugby. So yeah, I don't do as much sort of course leadership for GB hockey anymore. So I do bits and pieces of for the Hockey Hub. And sort of conferences and communities of practice and those sorts of things. I'm really enjoying actually working in other sports. It's stretching me. It's testing my ability to explain things, and it kind of takes the hockey out of it. I can walk into cricket and go, I know nothing about cricket. And
yeah, agreed. I think one of the my lasting memories around this approach, which we'll go on to later on, was actually a video that you may have done actually with regards to Oxford Brookes University with the Tendulkar and the way that he held a bat. And I think that for me was where it brought stuff to life, where I was able to say to others, you know, actually from a different sport, I could use a different sporting example. I wasn't really into cricket, still not really into cricket hugely, but you mentioned and you sort of demoed on this video about how Tendulkar held a bat and how if he came over to this country, we'd get him to hold a bat a completely different way. And look how good he is really when you look at the history books. So that's an interesting one, I think, there when you said you were working with cricket, because you obviously do know cricket, because I didn't realise that Tendulkar held a bat a different way.
Yeah, and there's examples in all sports of you know, people doing things differently, and then that almost creates an advantage most of the time. because what the opposition is seeing is something we haven't seen before, and that they've got to work it out. To an extent, the coach has just got to ask, is it helping or hindering? And if it's helping, then encourage it. I think we've moved away from technical models and there are principles for different technical bits and that help. But if you watch all the top drag flickers in the world, they're all different. If you watch the top golfers in the world, it all looks different. Same with the tennis. So, yeah, it's about helping the individual find the right solution to the movement problem. That, I think we've gone a bit too far the other way, which means we don't feel like we can step in anymore. But if we see something that's going to help them, then definitely.
Agreed. For sure. And that's definitely something we will touch on with this constraints-led approach later on when we have that chat around there for definite. And that's a really interesting point, that we don't feel comfortable in stepping in, and some people have taken it completely the other way. Yes. So your own hockey journey, let's have a little chat around that. When did you start getting involved in hockey, playing, etc.?
My hockey playing started at school. I think I had the teacher that loved hockey, and I was in a state school in Milton Keynes and played on a red grass. For those of you who are old enough to play on one of those, basically gravel. And then she pushed me to play in a local club in Milton Keynes, and then sort of really enjoyed playing at a junior level, and then went to university, and that's when I kind of really sort of picked up playing properly. And I think just the environment there of training 2-3 times a week, playing twice a week, just loved it. So then sort of enjoyed playing my club stuff for Cardiff, but never being a fantastic hockey player, always been an okay player, enjoyed playing really, and competing and being part of the team, and I'm hyper competitive.
I think a lot of people in the sporting world that's what they are, aren't they? They are competitive. They are. So
my work rate probably made up for my lack of technical ability, and probably my ability to know where to stand on the pitch probably helps as well. That and lacking about 6 yards of pace. So
from when did you start to introduce the coaching side? When did that start to sort of come in?
My first coaching job was when I shipped myself off to New Zealand for a year, and worked in a school at sort of the age of 18. That's when I first got, Danny, can you coach? And so I'm like, oh, yeah, cool. I kind of did what all coaches did, which was regurgitate what I'd had and things I'd liked, and just sort of not really any thought or theory or philosophy behind it. Just sort of started coaching how I'd coached or been coached. Then came back to uni, and it was after my third year I started coaching the university team. And I look back now and laugh, I think. There was a lot of cones. There was a lot of drills. there was a lot of block practice. And first season we got relegated. That was the start of my first coaching experience. Getting relegated. I think it's a badge of honour. It's got to happen to everyone.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It certainly does.
Then started to sort of do my badges. Sort of level one and level two, as it was back then in Wales. And then was just like pretty fortuitous to sort of get offered an opportunity to coach the girls' national league team, the Swansea Spartans, as they're called now. And then really lucky to work with another coach who really stretched me for those sort of 3 years. And it was in that period there that I really started to challenge what I was doing and really sort of change my approach. So. But I was thoroughly unqualified and way out of my depth. Which when people, other coaches actually, just that's pretty normal. If you feel like that, it's probably about right. And getting comfortable with being uncomfortable was one of the first things I sort of got used to.
And that's definitely something that is out there more now, and certainly through coach development world, that if you're comfy and you're permanently comfy within your coaching role, It you're probably not stretching yourself. You're probably not stretching the players. Is it the right environment? So, you know, being that uncomfortable doesn't mean every minute of every session.
Yeah.
But that uncomfortable feeling sometimes is a real challenge. And I personally believe that's a good place to be when you're uncomfortable, personally.
Same thing with our players. If we stretch our players, they're going to feel uncomfortable. It's going to be clunky, but we hope the development will take place. If we put ourselves in situations where we're a bit out of our depth, then as long as we've got the support, we'll develop and adapt, really. I think it's the same principle.
Yeah, agreed. So you're at Swansea with the girls, which I'll come back to us in National League with Swansea, sorry, in a second. We'll come back to that because you've said that there was some, I'll call it a light bulb. That's my little notes that I've written here. I've got a light bulb. After that, where did the journey take you after that? Where's things started to go then?
So I shifted jobs. So I got a job in Oxford Brookes University. Which meant I moved across, started coaching Oxford Hawks men, two and a half seasons, which was fantastic. It's a great club. Was sort of did the hardest thing ever, which was try to play a coach for a bit. Cool.
Yeah.
Quickly realised that I wasn't good enough player to do both jobs. And ended up doing both jobs badly. You're not playing properly because you're trying to coach, and you're not coaching properly because you're trying to play, and that I found that really tough. So sort of stopped playing almost. And then shifted to Southgate, and was there for 3 seasons, and which I loved. It's a fantastic club, and I really enjoyed time. Finished second in the conference 3 years in a row, which was tough. But that's a pretty, it's a tough league to get out of, and only one going to playoffs makes it hard. But fantastic bunch of guys there, and then shifted to Reading last year. But the shift to Reading was more of a not having the space to run a program really. So it's been nice going in as an assistant, doing once a week, and some of the games, rather than what it takes to run a program, which is twice a week, every game, the emails, the video, the recruitment, you know, so all of that work that goes in behind the scenes. I've almost, you know, just turning up and coaching has been lovely.
Yes, I can imagine. Okay, let's go all the way back to Swansea. You said that you were there. Yeah, you sort of, that's where there was some challenge for you and some stretch, and I wrote light bulb. So what was that? What sort of happened?
So a group of girls that were quite experienced hockey players, and a lot of them played a lot of National League, and we were sort of very used to doing drill block practice. We'd do loads of that, and we'd see them getting better at it. As happens, and you feel making real strides here. You know, ball pace is up, technical consistency is up. Mm-hmm. You know, they're feeling good, we're feeling good. But there was just zero transfer into the game. We still wouldn't make the 10-yard pass. and that was those moments there that was just like, this is not working.
Yeah.
And we're getting better in training, but it's not transferring to the game. And that was probably the biggest light bulb for me. And the other coach I coached with, a guy called Toby Nichols, who's still there, sort of the first person to mention the words linear and non-linear to me, and sort of plant those seeds in my head for those ideas. And then I've got a vivid memory of, it's called the two box game. Okay. So those players who've been coached by me will be groaning probably. and it's stolen off Zach, so yeah, I'll credit him for this one. Who probably stole it off someone else, but it's in the 25, there are two boxes, they're sort of 10 yards in from either end. You can score in either box.
Yeah.
You can dribble and pass in, and you're going to complete another pass on the way out. So it's 7v7, that sort of game. And three of the players walked off the pitch because they didn't. Basically, it was too much. It was like this massive overload of directions and transitions, and what their diet had been previously in hockey had been blocked, drilled practice, potentially followed by a standard game at the end of the training session.
Yeah.
And there's me coming along with this two-box practice with multi-directional, and it, like, they just couldn't work it out. I got so frustrated that they were like, well, what is this, and walked off. So it was almost like, oh, I've got this new idea, I'm going to use it. And then I found, like, actually with juniors, when you played that game, it was easier because they were sort of more malleable and more, I hadn't had that kind of fixed approach for so long.
Yeah. We're
drip feeding those elements in and slightly, basically starting to increase the chaos slowly,
mm-hmm.
making things more game based. But also the players wanted, like, technical block practice.
Yeah.
So to start with, we still had to give them probably more than we wanted of that stuff. And slowly drip feed in the game based stuff. So, and then start to sort of realize that that's what they was helping and they were enjoying it.
Yeah.
And then that was almost like a sliding scale, I guess, over a season or a season and a half.
And what you're describing there to me, before you went into your two box game, was hockey, and it was hockey for forever. You know, the drills, the cone, the movement. When I first started many, many, many years ago, playing on a grass pitch, went to training. I was attending with my dad. There was some stuff down on a hockey pitch on the grass where the ball would move from X, Y, Z, probably go into the back of the net.
Yeah,
and then there was some kind of game at the end on a grass pitch, and then they're going to games at a weekend. It moved to Astro, it stayed the same. So those girls that you mentioned walking off, their brains must have been completely and utterly fried by the thought of, I can score here, I can go in there, I can go this way, that way, left, right, up, down. You know, you can understand why they were frustrated. I'm not sure if they were frustrated with you or frustrated with the game.
Okay.
possibly. Yeah. How did they, so what happened to them? Did they ever get round? Did they ever sort of...
Oh, they're fine. Well, I guess they were like, hockey players, hyper-competitive, wanted to do well, wanted to be good at everything, and all of a sudden this was like, what is this? Frustration, I think, is probably what they were feeling.
Yeah.
More than anything else.
Challenging their learning, challenging, you know, all the things that we want to see now. That was that in that moment. Shame that you couldn't have recorded it, because that would have been amazing to show, wouldn't it?
Yes. Good hockey players, like, experienced internationals and national league players. So it wasn't a slight on them. It was more a slight on me, offering them something that was just way outside what they'd had before and too much. But that's a great learning moment for me. That I think now, if you drop that game down with a group, I think what people are offering hockey players now has changed. So
yeah,
we'll be most more used to it and we'll be able to adapt within it.
The ones that haven't. That sort of game there, that sort of activity, as you mentioned, the block drills at the beginning. Yes, you know, we want to see less of that and more of the gameplay scenario. You might use your block drill type thing in a goldfish bowl if necessary for one or two people to utilize, if that's what they need to work on, maybe only for a couple of minutes before they come back into your game. But actually, if a club or a coach is really struggling to sort of change, then drip feeding these bits in and out will help eventually, you know.
I think we've been guilty in shifting the pendulum perhaps too far and just there was too much emphasis on block practice and drill based stuff. We can't hide behind that. We've shifted fully to the game stuff, but it's probably a bit, needs to sort of row back a little bit. But then it's more into the nuances of it, and this is where I sort of. So there are good games and bad games, and there are good technical practices and bad technical practices.
Agreed.
There's still a place for technical practices. It's important. If you want technical development, you need to choose practices that are going to develop the technical bits. But there are good ways. I think there are ways with good practice of doing that, and there are ways that are less. And I guess the key question I'd ask is, will it transfer? How can we make this technical practice more like the game? Can we add some variability into it?
Mm-hmm.
We add some movement into it. You know, can we add some decisions into it, even though those decisions might not be opposed? And those are the the thing. So we want to get better at trapping and push passing. And in order to get better at trapping and push passing, that you can't hide from the fact we need to do a lot of trapping and push passing.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Yeah.
Can we make every trap and every push pass slightly different? Can we make the environment a little bit more dynamic?
Yeah.
Can we make the players have to sort of choose when and when not to pass through gaps of players or moving players, rather than stood on a line, passing to someone else static, stood on a line? And that's the nuance, I think, that mm-hmm. been lost, I guess. It's,
yeah.
So, yeah, though people are now scared of doing any form of technical practice, I think, because they're like, oh, we can't do that.
Yeah, I think they think the word technical practice means a block drill. A lot of people that I speak to think that's what that is. And it's like, we're not allowed to do that. No, actually, technical practice is exactly what you've just mentioned there. And it may be an underload, overload situation to allow that to happen more. So obviously an overload situation in a small condensed area, maybe like a 3 versus 2 inside a box. The three are working on their pushing and trapping, and are getting rewarded for that. Possibly would be an idea to do. Is that the sort of thing that you're thinking about?
Yeah, that's still opposed. I still think we can sort of go back down the continuum a bit and do unopposed stuff with.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Groups. Yeah. We've got a box. We've got groups of three in it.
Yeah.
You need to pass the ball between your three, but meanwhile there are 4 or 5 other groups of three in the same box completing the same task.
Oh, okay. Yes.
I've got to find the gap between the other groups to find my player on my team, and they've got to move to find a gap, and so we can even wind it back to that. I think. It just got some chaos and some variability in it. But yeah, like the recent papers come out in hockey, all they did was sort of count the number of passes and traps in different types of practices, and you do a possession game without direction, players pass the ball more.
Yeah.
If you add a direction, that shifts a bit more to carrying as well, which kind of makes sense. So if you want them to do more passing and trapping, then perhaps something that's more possession based might work.
Yeah.
But then that's a little bit less game based, but that's okay as well. So yeah, I think it's choosing the right tool for the right job, which you'll hear lots of sort of guys like Professor Chris Cushion sort of really pushing. Let's not be as black and white with this. Let's get coaching. Yeah. Coaching is a decision making.
It is.
Job, and you have to decide, make lots of decisions as a coach. What type of practice? What type of feedback? What type of intervention? What type of conversation? All those. That's all a decision making process. What we need to get is coaches better at making decisions. What's the issue? What's the intention? Therefore, what's the best practice to solve that problem? And I think we get to that point.
Andy,
we're in a much better place.
Yeah, agreed. And that's coming. That's definitely better now than it was a year ago, than it was 2 years ago, than it was 3 years ago. We're certainly making some strides with that. And there's some, you see, and I think I had this discussion actually with the coach developers that are just been appointed by England Hockey, or started in January, some of them, in my last podcast. So with Matt, Paul and Sam, chatting to them, and actually we're seeing some good stuff, but actually we're probably exposing ourselves to see the good stuff. And actually now we need to start to see the stuff that we actually need to support. The guys that are going, I don't know, I can't do it, I'm struggling. The guys that are putting their hands up, you know, everyone that's putting their hand up, we need to see. There's obviously going to be people that don't even tell us at all. So then, you know, it's that. And it isn't about ramming it down their throat. I think we were talking about this off this podcast, actually. It is around planting seeds and sort of giving them some opportunity to trial and error with it and make them feel slightly comfortable with it. Also have that uncomfortable feeling, but make them feel comfortable enough that they can do this. They can do this. That's what they need.
Yeah, there's 2 or 3 things in that. One is, I got 3 things because I like to talk. Bang for your bucks is a really good argument. So you've got an hour a week with a group of players.
Yeah.
Like, what's the biggest bang for your buck in that hour? You know, can I do stuff that's got decisions and actions in it as well as much as possible, give them as many touches as possible, make it as like the game as possible, and some stretch. If I'm a full-time program and I've got 5-6 sessions a week with a group, then I might be able to do some more space for some different stuff. So I think there's a is that what are you offering the players based on what time you've got? Time is probably the most precious resource that we have with players, time and pitch space.
Yeah.
The second thing is when we like an idea, we feel like we want to try it, but we don't know what to do. We start to feel uncomfortable. So it's no wonder we deviate back to doing what we've always done. We see players do it. They just deviate back to their kind of default, what they feel comfortable with, which kind of makes absolute perfect sense as well. And I've absolutely forgotten my third point, but I reckon.
Not a problem. Now, and that's fine. I completely understand. And the one thing that everyone needs to realise here, it is time. And that time that they have, they need to find out what is best for that group. And actually understanding their players. So many coaches I've spoke to, you speak to them, what do your players need? What do your players want? And when you ask that question, you kind of get a little bit of a blank face. And actually, that's some valuable info that you need to find out so that you understand and you can understand. Actually, when I'm beginning to create some technical stuff, some tactical stuff, some to move this team or this squad forward, this group of people, what do we actually need to work on? And that has to be thought around. And, you know, I remember I spoke to Jack Rolfe about this earlier and thing, but I think over the years, people possibly would get to imagine your training was 7 o'clock on a Tuesday. They'd get to around 4 o'clock. It's coming to the end of the day at work. They're thinking, right, I need to think about what I'm going to coach tonight. Yeah, I'm just going to do these activities because this is what I need to do. We need to work on, we need to work at getting the ball out the back. And they just do an activity of getting the ball out the back and there's some pressure and we might do it unopposed to start with and put some pressure on. That's fine. But actually, then they talk about it didn't work on Saturday and it didn't work in this. We need to figure out really what are the needs of those players to make and what are the wants? You know, do they agree with the way that you're playing the ball out the back? Do they actually understand it? What do they need? What do they feel they need? What are you looking at? Because each player is different. And I don't think we think about that enough. I don't think people think about that enough when they're going coaching. We're definitely getting better at it. People that are coming through our workshops and courses are definitely getting better at it. But again, it's just time. Do you have enough time to be able to plan it effectively? Because session design is key. It doesn't mean that you need every minute of every part of your session put down. I rarely have that. Have a skeleton. But yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head with time.
Two bits for me that are important here is one, as coaches, we like to see with order and yeah. in the chaos. So we feel like our job's to help the players organise this dynamic, chaotic game that we're seeing in front of you. And therefore, we try and either organise it for them, so we see the chaos and we organise it for them rather than letting them organise within it. Or we strip it back because that makes us feel more comfortable. So drills feel more comfortable because they're controlled. We see it as neat and tidy, and actually we feel more comfortable as a coach. Games are chaotic, and that makes us feel uncomfortable. And we'll see errors. And I stood behind a coach. I've just told this story a few times, but I was doing he was doing an awesome practice, which I've since stolen. pretended it was mine. He was sort of noticeably uncomfortable and sort of getting vexed and started to get ratty with the players and sort of scolding and it, good intentions because he wanted them to get better and sort of came over and asked him how he was feeling and what was going on. He just said they keep mucking up in other language. And I said, oh, we've got it about right, haven't you? And it was that moment where he's like, what do you mean? And I was like, well, your job's to design failure almost.
Yeah, yeah.
If you do it from the start, then there's no development and learning happened within the practice. Like, let it breathe. And he was like, oh, okay. So I think that pressure that coaches feel to design something that the players can do perfectly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely not going to happen on a match day, is it? The world is definitely not going to be perfect.
Then he said, well, the players are getting frustrated. Well, let's talk to the players. So I had to sort of explain to some of the groups I've coached before, is my job is to design stuff that's hard for you. Will be clunky at times and you will have to work it out and you will get a bit frustrated. Not all the time, but, you know, so sort of ask players as they walk off the pitch sometimes, how was the session today? Yeah, loved it, which basically meant I did all right and my team won probably.
Well,
I was training today. Oh, you know, and other noises, you know, which probably meant it was hard, it was clunky, and I made some errors. So that mindset from coaches is your job is to design failure, design chaos, and let it breathe, but then help them organize against it and help them with principles or questions or prompts or space or whatever you want to add in. The other one is take the pressure off yourself from designing games that you think are going to do what you think they're going to do, because you've got no idea how the players are going to interact with what you've designed. So yeah, having an open mind for that, I think, is really what has been a big thing for me as well. Like, you want to work on this, you design a practice to work on it, and it completely doesn't do what you thought it was going to do. That's pretty normal as well.
Yeah, I've definitely been there. And yes, it adds a bit of pressure, adds a bit of tension, but it, for me, I actually put it back to them. I go, okay, well, this is what I thought was going to happen. It hasn't. So how do you think we can now resolve this? What do you think we need to do as a group? So from a whatever point of view, attack, defense point of view, what do you think we need to do to get it right? They've tried it, they've tweaked it, they've moved it on. They felt a lot better when they could design a better game than I could. So, you know, success for them. They were all taking the mic. Maybe we should lead the coaching session, Gary. Maybe you should. Yeah. Maybe you should.
Also being open with the players, going, look, I've designed this. I've got no idea what's going to happen here. Let's see. It could be a bit clunky while we tweak it. Rather than going, I'm the coach, I've got the practice, you know, and not doing what I wanted to do, so I'm going to get frustrated and shout at the players because they're not doing the actions and behaviours that I want them to do within it. And I think that's important as well.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, we've kind of gone into this constraints-led approach anyway. Obviously, you've got a book. Do you want to talk about your book that you've just brought out? Might as well give that a plug while we're on here.
It's thunder on me, that one. The book's called The Constraints-Led Approach, Principles for Practice Design. It's pitched at sort of a bridge between the theory and the practice. So we hope that coaches will be able to pick it up and read it. We've sort of jargon busted a lot of the words and made sense of them. There's some theory chapters with some of the words explained. There's some bridging chapters with some principles. And then there's some practical chapters that explain how we put this into practice in sessions. So, there's a lot of sort of misunderstanding and surface level understanding of what a constraints-led approach is and what it isn't and what it can and can't do. And that's kind of one of the motivations behind it. And the application of it is quite nuanced, which is what the book kind of talks about, really. But what it does do, and hopefully as coaches read it, they start to go, oh, that's why I do that. Oh, that kind of makes sense. So the constraints-led approach captures how the human body organizes movement solutions. Mm-hmm. That is it. So where there's a task, an environment, and an individual, they will perceive and act, and as a result of those three things, they will produce a movement solution. So wherever there's a movement solution, there's been a constraints-led approach.
Yeah, agree. Yeah. Seems so simple when you say it like that, Danny.
The analogy I'd give is my nan hoovering the lounge, constraints-led approach. Player dribbling around cones on the floor, constraints-led approach. Player playing a small-sided game, constraints-led approach. It doesn't prescribe, it's not the magic bullet for coaching or practice design. But understanding it might start to help us make some of the decisions that we need to make as a coach. Mm-hmm. So if a player's doing a particular action and we want to, or making a decision and we want to influence that, then we might start to think, oh, how can I influence the task that's going to cause them to make that change? And it helps us understand that, like, if we do put cones on the floor, the logical decision from a player is to look at the floor, because the task requires them to look at the floor. That makes logical sense for a six-year-old to do, and then the coach tells them to look up while they're dribbling through the cone. Well, that kind of doesn't make any sense to a six-year-old, because the task you've set me is to dribble around the things you put on the floor.
Yeah.
Obviously, the ball's on the floor, which always means we're going to have an eye on the floor, I think, and an awareness of where the ball is in relation to our stick and our body. I think that's important. But what we want to develop in our players is to be able to do that and be able to scan and look up and sort of perceive as well. Well, what might help them do that is if we put them in a box with a load of other people with a hockey ball, that if they don't look up, they might bump into them. Then we hope they might start to organise their body in relation to the stick and the ball, you know, to manage that problem as well, and therefore develop movement solutions that will allow them to sort of scan and look up as well as look at the ball. And it's really as simple as that. Now, there's a load more theory and detail that sits underneath it, but ultimately, constraints of the approach is the movement solution produced will come as a result of the individual, so size, shape, emotion, fatigue level, environment, so the pitch, the weather, the rain, the light, and the task. Mm-hmm. And that, the task is probably what we're more used to manipulating, so boundaries of the pitch, the position of the goals, the rules, the number of players, the you know, the specific point scoring system, you know, we want to add. So we've always seen coaches manipulate those things. And then that's all it is. It's like this menu for coaches to sit in front of and go, right, what do I need to manipulate here to try and get what I want out of the session?
Yeah.
And if we view it like that, I think we start to open up this is a tool or a framework to help coaches design practices rather than this is a theory that prescribes a practice or prescribes to do a certain thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, agree. Yeah, completely. So if we put that into a little practice somehow here, we've got even numbers, uneven numbers, it doesn't really matter which. The constraint may be that you've seen an individual that is, so we're looking at a little bit technical here, but we've seen an individual that is me. I can't tackle. I am a terrible tackler of the ball. So you really want me now to be focusing on winning the ball back, open side of the stick only. Yeah, because I've got this habit, bad habit of coming in, thinking I can shave tackle. I can't tackle. So my constraint is that I am physically now trying to technical shape myself into winning the ball back with a forehand tackle. That's my constraint. You might individually constrain or you might team constrain people, a whole team where they can only win the ball back a certain way. Agreed? That's a real simple way of me looking at it.
Kind of. We must view constraints as boundaries that shape movement solutions. So if you and I were to race up the stairs, we would develop different movement solutions based on our limb length, which is the kind of individual constraint. The depth and frequency of the step, so whether we go one step, two steps, you know, that will, the task will determine what movement solution we create. And then the environment, is it slippy? Is it wet? Is it dry? So we will, now what we need to do, we want you to get better at forehand tackling, we want you to get better at winning the ball back cleanly. We need to design the practice that offers you lots of opportunities to do that.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. So how do I get you to make a lot of tackles? Well, I need the opposition to probably dribble the ball more.
Yeah.
Rather than pass it. Mm-hmm. What do you reckon? Do you want you closer to the ball or further away?
Closer, really.
So then we start to think, so I'm testing you here, aren't I, live on your podcast.
Thanks.
Are you feeling uncomfortable? We talked about this earlier.
Yeah, probably shouldn't have brought this up.
So we then want the space to probably be smaller.
Yeah.
Which will offer you a lot more opportunities to make these tackles. If we make it big, then you're going to find it harder to get closer to players and they're more likely to pass it because they're going to get their eyes up. Mm-hmm. There's loads of things like that. We probably don't want an overload. In terms of attacking, because there will always be an opportunity for the players to pass the ball, so there'll be less opportunities for you to make those tackles. We might even add a player in on the defensive side so that we can start to get two players around the player on the ball. So that's the kind of practice design for a bit first. I offer you loads and loads of opportunities to make tackles. Here's the interesting bit. What I might do is offer you a bonus point every time you make a clean tackle.
I don't get many of them, Danny. I'll tell you now.
I think it's worth trying to see if that will influence it. However, think what the opposition would do. If they know that you get a bonus point every time you make a clean tackle, what do you think they're going to start doing?
Trying to get me not to make a clean tackle?
Yeah, they'll pass it. So they'll pass the ball and not offer you that opportunity.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's a bit of a, like, we call this co-adaptation, but we've got to understand. So what we might do is not tell the opposition.
That might be
an individual point scoring system I put on you based on your development needs.
So I've now got a secret challenge. I love a secret challenge. So
absolutely. So we design a game that offers you the opportunity to make those tackles, and then I encourage you to make them. But sometimes if we tell the opposition what I'm encouraging you to do, they'll take that away. Does that make sense? Why would I offer you the opportunity to make a tackle when you get a point?
Yeah.
So there's those in, this is the fun bit when we get into this sort of stuff. Then also, if you're struggling to make a tackle, I might help you with your tackling technique. Do you know what I mean? I might help you with some principles, staying mobile. Yeah. You know, it's like, what is forehand? Like, how do I stay two hands, not one? How do I stay more balanced? And then what we might do is we might take you out of this small-sided game and put you into something that's 1v1.
Yeah.
And specifically put the start positions of the players and the ball feed in so that it offers you the opportunity to come in and make a forehand tackle.
But the other activity potentially still going on, if it was only me or a couple of people that needed to work on that activity still goes on. And this is in Amy Price's world, I think, is where I listened to it the first time around. Goldfish bowl. That's my goldfish bowl.
That might be you coming out into a goldfish bowl and actually doing that. We might strip everyone out and set up 1v1s all over the place and do it and then come straight back in. What it doesn't do in that instance is help you decide when to come in and make a forehand tackle as much. It's reducing the chaos of the game, but what you might need to focus on the technical bit, and then we put it back into the game. It's hard.
Absolutely, it's hard. Just wish that I would have had that coaching sort of 20 odd years ago, maybe 30 years ago. I'm going to be 40 soon, so maybe 30 years ago I might got to this age and be able to tackle a little bit more consistently than I can now. I mean, I haven't played for a couple of seasons anyway, so my tackling is going to be completely and utterly out of question nowadays. I might as well just not bother. So,
And then how many times a week do we get frustrated with players because they make the same sort of errors?
Yeah.
Constantly. Okay. You know, how many times have I told him that? How many times have I spoke to her about that?
I remember having a coach. I had a coach for two or three seasons that would constantly talk to me about my tackling, and it was like, we need you to be higher up the pitch, and then when you are getting the ball, we're in a better position. That's fine, but when you are tackling, we're gonna. And he would still. I remember I'd ever get to every preseason. This season, Gary, we're going to get you to tackle better. Well, we've not done it yet. So, and again, we would try all sorts in boxes, perfectly fine inside a box, in a really condensed box, one on one, but outside of that. No, not, you know, in a game real situation, the tackling wasn't the greatest. So I spoke to a few umpires on these podcasts and, you know, still played at a fairly decent level, you know, in the regional leagues, quite high up in those. But I just really couldn't tackle. And they would just laugh as an umpire because they knew that this was going to happen. And they could tell me every week, we're going to tell you off for your tackle. Yes, you're right. So, yeah. Well,
what we'd need to do is cause a reorganization of your movement system and then strip it back to that. But ultimately, you can't hide away from the fact that we just need to give you loads and loads of goes of tackling.
Opportunities to tackle, which I didn't get. I'm going to be honest with you, I didn't get. Nobody gave me that opportunity other than in a one-on-one inside a box. That was that.
And then what we do, strip it back further, is we're going to do it against a cone. You know, we're going to, like that. That would be what I remember doing when I was a junior. Was sort of running up to a cone and putting your left hand on the floor, running up to the next cone and putting your left hand on the floor. You know, so
And
for me, that's a conditioning exercise that gets you better at bending down.
Yeah, it still didn't make me tackle.
not an exercise that's going to make me better in a game tackling.
Agreed. That's really interesting. Hopefully, that gives people some understanding around the constraint stuff. I want to know now, for you, where have you seen the greatest success in this? You know, you've started this, you know, I told you at the beginning, a guru of coaching. I remember being introduced to you 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and you just wowed me with different bits, you know, and it's a little bit like I hold you in the same light as I hold Rusty and Fletch in the fact of, you know, you wowed me. So where have you seen the greatest success with this?
I just think that the working with a group with the Welsh guys over 7 years, I think we've seen seen it really pay dividends in terms of, we haven't got much contact time, so we have to make sure the bang for the buck. And then just exploring these ideas with Zach and the players in trying to make our practices ask the questions that the teams we're going to play in international hockey are going to ask, in order to best prepare them for that question when they're on the pitch.
Yeah.
I think that's the way we've really, really looked at it. And I think the co-adaptation piece has been the biggest one for us. So what I mean by that is the biggest question a team get asked is by the opposition.
Yeah.
Amy Price will talk about outwitting the opposition, and they're trying to outwit you. And that's essentially captures the game and in a phase. So how do we get a team to play in a certain way, which is going to ask the question that the team that we're going to play is going to ask? So we were going to the Commonwealth Games, very lucky to go to Australia, and we were going to play teams that were significantly higher ranked than us.
Mm-hmm.
So the question that asked compared to the question that the tournament went to afterwards, which was in Croatia, which was where we were one of the more high-ranked teams, and we're going to play Eastern European teams that play half-court, third-court zones, was very different.
Yeah.
So it was about getting, how do we design practices that ask the right question that's going to develop the skills, the tactical understanding and the strategy stuff for them to answer it. So our training sessions looked so different in that block compared to the block before,
yeah,
before the Commonwealth Games. And I think that's where we've started to really look at what the players need to be able to do in the games and then try and design our practices to,
okay,
to create, yeah, that. That's where, and we don't really do much technical work with the seniors. I think we try and that we sort of hope that's been done in the clubs and, mm-hmm, in the domestic seasons. We've only got a small amount of time with them, so we need to make sure this is as close to the game as possible. And then the little tricks we've added, I guess, that are like easy take homes. Portable scoreboard, game changer.
Yeah,
just like a plug and play scoreboard. So players being able to see the time of the period and the score and contextualize their decisions against it has been huge. Because that's one of the biggest things as you go up the level is it's not like whether I throw a crossfield aerial or a crossfield reverse stick cross is based on the time of the game and the score. It could be a good decision, it could be a terrible decision. I think that's been huge. And then clearly defined periods of play. So we're going to play 5 4-minute blocks with 2 minutes in between each period. The times are up, you know, and that, I think that's really helped rather than just let's play for a generic period of time and see what happens. So those little take homes have really changed how training feels.
Yeah, which is good. That really, really interesting to hear. Challenge wise, what do you think's been what's the biggest challenge that you've turned into a success? I don't know whether you've got one, but I think I'll ask it. So the biggest challenge within the
biggest question I've got. Yeah, I guess a couple of things. When I started coaching international hockey, I hadn't played international hockey. I hadn't played Premier League hockey, and I played a tiny bit of National League stuff. So I was sort of speaking to players who got, 100 caps, older than me, so like that's quite. And I guess that was a real like, oh, they're going to listen to me? And I'm like, what do I know? Like, and I basically just then went around asking questions. Because I was like, what do I know? So I just, I think that really helped me. I think it was like that awareness that, I don't really know. And then just being able to have the conversation with them, I think really helped. So that, I think that was definitely one of the challenges when I started coaching internationally. I've not played at this level. I don't even know what it feels like. Who am I to come in and tell them what should or shouldn't be doing?
Which is dead, similar to, a proportion of coaches in this country who have never played at the level that they're coaching at, and they probably get questioned, they probably feel uncomfortable, but you and many others are showing that you don't need to have played the game at a high level. You just need to have a great understanding of how to get the best out of players at that level.
And not like being a complete sort of badger for the game of hockey, if you like, really looking into the, like wanting to understand and know the game, and I think it's hugely important, especially if you want to apply this approach we've just talked about. How do you know what moving the pitch is going to do if you don't know what, you don't really understand the game? So that's the thing I'd get coaches to work on. The other one is, or the biggest question I'm having in coaching is how hands off, I guess, within these practices should I be? And I guess I think this approach has led to us saying, oh, the game's the teacher, and sort of stepping back and not coaching.
Yeah.
So the biggest question I'm kind of exploring in my coaching is, how much corrective feedback do I give during the game? Mm-hmm. How much, you know, how much do I wait to do individual stuff afterwards? How much on the run? So that kind of intervention behavior, sort of an analysis, I guess, is something that I'm really thinking about a lot in my practice at the minute. And there's players who basically, especially the seniors, go, "Damn, shut up."
Yeah.
Let's work it out first, please. You know, and then I feel like I'm not doing enough. So, and then you put them into the group discussion thing's interesting, because I think the Welsh guys are good now because we've done it for so long. They actually have a really meaningful conversation about the question I've asked them. But I think to start with, it becomes very generic of, right, what are you doing right? And it's, or space, or communicating well, you know, intensity is good, you know. And actually, it was Jason.
You get that from a lot, don't you? You get that from a lot of players where they'll say the generic buzzword that they think is right rather than actually really thinking about what it is. So
Jason actually asked a really good one, just kind of used a lot now, is from the last 5 minutes in your groups, describe one phase of play that you thought was really good and why it was really good.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good question.
Rather than taking them from a 5 minute block of what did you do well in this 5 minute block?
Yeah.
So generic.
Yeah.
Pinpoint a real phase within that you think you did well. Mm. I think that, and that was like, oh, that's a really good way. Or ask a more specific question. Like, right, this is the new rule coming in your groups. Decide how you're going to adapt to, which is like what happens in hockey. All of a sudden, you wonder, like, with 5 minutes to go, they pull the goalie off. Like, what do you do? You know, that kind of like.
Yeah, a scenario really, isn't it? Like, this is what's happening. What are you going to do now in this scenario?
Yeah. So looking forward, what you're going to do next, rather than going, right, what was good? And it just becomes a bit generic. And then Rusty made a good point to me, actually, make them accountable for their discussion. Like, go over, say, what did you talk about? What are you going to do in this next one? Yeah. Great. And then in the next one, go, right, make them, did you do it? why not? You know, and actually, so stop those discussions becoming too generic. Been a challenge for me lately.
Yeah, that's good. That's really good. So, look, that's been, again, 50 minutes has flown by. We've only really scratched the surface of some of the stuff that I was thinking around, but that just shows you how conversation flows. So, definitely want to speak to you again. I'll probably have more questions next time from some of the listeners sending stuff in, and I'm sure this will prompt discussion as ever on social media. I think you've given a really insightful look into your journey, but also the constraint less approach. Just, you know, it's fascinating watching what you do, and you've allowed us in as well through Facebook, where you did a Wales Facebook Live of your training sessions. I think that's, you know, that's great that you've done that. It's very open as well, because, you know, you never knew what was going to go on in that session. I'm pretty sure you were confident it was going to work out fine, but yeah, you know, that's very open. A Facebook Live, I like that.
Just pretty wonderful.
Just didn't know
what else to do either. I was like, oh, this is a live version of it not working.
Overall, just thank you for that really insightful chat there. Thanks for sharing the stuff that you do on social media and having input through my journey on my ACP and stuff like that over the time, and sort of opening my eyes in my journey. It's been great, and I'm sure you've opened many others that will listen to this podcast.
Thanks, Gary. Appreciate the conversation, mate. Let's carry them on.
Yeah, I will try. We'll try. Time, Danny, is the big thing here. Time, we've already spoke around. But yeah, really grateful for the chat. Thanks very much.
Cheers, Gary.